This episode is dedicated to the memory of Adrian Schiller.
Hello, and welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. Sitting in front of me in New York is co-host Alexandra Gellner, aka Alex.
And sitting in front of me in London is co-host Samantha Michka, aka Sam or Dr. Sam.
This is our first recording since the start of 2025, so how is 2025 treating you so far?
Let's see. We're recording this early January. Let's just say my existential dread hasn't set in quite yet.
For future podcast archivists, the world is literally on fire because LA and a lot of California is genuinely on fire at this point in time, which gives a big clue as to when we're actually doing this recording. Politically, I'm kind of sitting looking around the world going, what the hell? It's a lot. It's a lot.
So far, I'm
sort of getting back into the groove of, between Christmas and New Year is always crazy, but starting to go back to, getting into my theatre-going groove again and going to see stuff, and I'll try and be quick, but can I just very briefly talk about The Merchant of Venice 1936?
Please, yes, go for it.
Have you heard of it?
Nope.
Oh, buckle in. So
I'm ready.
Okay, so Merchant of Venice, obviously, by Shakespeare.
I've heard of Merchant of Venice, not the one.
Yeah, yeah. Yes. No, that was kind of a
several times.
Really? You haven't heard it?
I am an actor.
I'm an actor. I've never heard of The Merchant of Venice, but so
William who?
Yeah, who? Shakespeare? Who that? No, Merchant of Venice, 1936. The 1936 is the crucial bit. So, cut a very long story short, British actor Tracy Ann Oberman has worked with a broader team and has done an adaptation of The Merchant of Venice, in which she plays the first ever female Shylock. Mm. And she is a female Jewish moneylender in the East End of London in 1936. At the time of the Battle of Cable Street. So do you know about the Battle of Cable Street? Have you heard of it? Is it on your radar?
You know it's not.
To be fair, when you came over here, you were in Birmingham, so it's a little bit far away. So anyway, buckle up. Whistle stop tour of the Battle of Cable Street. So 4th of October, 1936. You have this guy called Oswald Mosley. And he is the leader of the British Union of Fascists. Clues in the name. They're not a very nice group. He's not a very nice man. So they decide that because they're fascists and they want to blame Jews and immigrants for everything, they're going to march through London's East End. At that point, sort of Whitechapel, Stepney, in that area, there was a really large Jewish community. But you also had, Irish immigrants, African immigrants, Italians, Germans, literally a genuine melting pot from all over Europe and the world. So they decided that they were going to march through. And I think it was something like 3,000 fascists, something ridiculous like that, decided that they were going to march through Whitechapel, through the East End. And they started off by gathering really close to the Tower of London. 3,000 fascists, 7,000 police as protection. So then what they decided to do was that they were going to march through Whitechapel, but a huge crowd of EastEnders, not from the soap opera, and anti-fascists decided that essentially, to quote, you know, the slogan from the Spanish Civil War, no pass around, they shall not pass. So the numbers vary. So some people say it's 50,000, other sources say it was up to 100,000 marched against them, and the two sides clashed on Cable Street and what became known as the Battle of Cable Street. What happens is, essentially, despite the police protection, Mosley and the fascists get absolutely trounced, and the East End kind of wins the day. Everyone came together and basically said, no, this isn't happening. So that is the Battle of Cable Street, and that's the background that The Merchant of Venice 1936 is set in. And if anyone's interested, you can go and visit Cable Street today. So obviously it's still there. And there's this massive mural, and there's a blue plaque as well, which commemorates, you know, the Battle of Cable Street, where the East End of London rose up against the fascists. So proof that we've done it before, people. Can we keep doing it, please? Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
So what did you think of The Merchant of 1936?
So my friend and I, we gave it a solid 3.5 out of 5 stars, mainly because some of the accents were very difficult to understand. There was one guy who was doing RP that sounded like he had a broom handle so far up his backside, we weren't even sure if he was speaking English. And one of the actors, I felt, in my humble opinion, was quite wooden, and I felt very much like I was watching a play. But overall, it did what I really love, and it was making me think, and it was, you know, sort of this shimmering in and out of liking a character one minute and feeling a bit of sympathy and empathy towards them, and then going, oh no, actually I really don't like you, you're a really nasty person. So the fact that Portia is essentially a fascist, and Bassanio and Antonio, and, you know, Antonio is the leader of the Black Shirts, and he's sort of this very kind of Mosley-ish character. There was also this layer of homoeroticism between, it was implied that Antonio was a closeted gay man, and, you know, had feelings for Bassanio, but couldn't do anything about it. And I was, it was just this, I mean, this is definitely another conversation for us to have in another episode, but I just really disliked that trope of the gay fascist, because when you look at paragraph 175 and how gay men were persecuted by the Nazis, and how after the war they couldn't say why they had been in the concentration camps, because paragraph 175 meant that homosexuality was still illegal in Germany, and this whole thing around, oh, it's more likely that the Nazis would have been gay than the, or closeted gay than the actual gay men. And for me, that was kind of problematic. I very much appreciate that as a cis straight white woman, that's just my opinion. But that's another story for another time.
Sure.
But yeah, just the whole, it really made you think. Really made you think. So would I recommend it as a piece of theatre to get you thinking and get the wheels turning, and think about also the call to action? Yeah, definitely. I just feel that there are a couple of aspects of the production that could have been improved, but that's just me.
Yeah,
it just opens up so many questions, and that's one of the reasons why I really, really like it, is because you come away thinking and processing.
And that's why we go to the theatre.
How about you? Have you seen anything recently you want to recommend or review, or anything coming up?
Well, let's see. I mean, I guess I have to go see The Brutalist, because this is our job. But I haven't seen it yet.
Remind me about that one.
It's the film that's just come out with Adrien Brody.
I don't know anything about it.
Adrien Brody playing a survivor of the Holocaust coming to America. And finding a new home, and he's an architect, so
Oh, and hence the Brutalist. Okay, yep.
The Brutalist, yes. So that's on my list to watch soon. But in the meantime, I highly recommend this New York Times article, The Holocaust Grandchildren Are Speaking Now. So it's talking about, there's been a wave happening of new works and films. Mm-hmm. We have Real Pain. That had just come out, and so just talking about the third generation, you know, retelling their, you know, grandparents' stories and reflecting on this time in our history, being these many generations removed. So that's by Mark Tracy.
Ooh, is that T-R-A-C-E or
Mark Tracy? Yes, T-R-A-C-Y, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So, and it just, it's a really, I think it's a good read. It goes into, you know, how we've, I guess, just our retelling, our reflections of the Holocaust through art has just, how it's evolved, you know, starting mostly with the NBC miniseries, The Holocaust, and then there's a new wave after 1993's Schindler's List. And then we had the opening of all of these Holocaust memorials and museums, namely the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. So it just, I think that's a really, it's a really interesting read, just like, you know, to think about how we, what we're talking about on this podcast, just, you know, how do we portray this through, I mean, we're mostly talking about the medium of theater, but I imagine we're also going to delve into film, touch on film. Yeah, I will say.
Point.
So yeah, with that, I think that's, you know, we've caught up. So
well, before
shall we
get
to our disclaimers?
I was gonna say, yeah, let's, before we get right into the episode, the disclaimers.
All right, great. So number one, Sam and I both work for separate organizations, listeners. But this podcast is entirely on us. This is our project, our passion project. We don't represent those organizations in this capacity. So if you don't like something you hear, it's all on us. Don't be going to our workplaces.
Yeah, please don't. Please don't. So disclaimer number two, Alex and I do use humor as a coping mechanism. It's our safety valve. We need it. To cope, we make jokes, we laugh. We keep ourselves from going under. We are not mocking the Holocaust. We are not mocking victims or survivors. We in no way at all intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humor at times, so just please do bear this in mind while listening.
All right, this last one is less a disclaimer. The more, so we call it more the rule of engagement. We want to hear from you. If you have questions about a play or an episode, a suggestion for an episode, a correction, please do reach out to us. We're leaving the contact details in our show notes.
Great. So, shall we get into it?
Let's do it. Please be warned that we will be discussing a play that touches on distressing topics, including sexual violence and suicide, which may be triggering for trauma survivors.
Okay, so, Alex, it's 1960 in Bonn, Germany. On the shop floor of a chocolate-making factory, 65-year-old Wilhelm Lohmann is overseeing female workers. One of the workers drops a piece of chocolate onto the floor. Witnessed by Lohmann, she tries unsuccessfully to remedy the situation as he finally explodes in fury. Humiliated and tearful, the female worker is suddenly off the hook as two German policemen enter the factory, put Lohmann in handcuffs, and take him away. Wilhelm Lohmann is actually SS Obergruppenführer Wilhelm Kopp, known as the Butcher of Kulmhof, and accused of complicity in the mass murder of over 300,000 Jews in Poland during the war. He's finally been found. And so opens Dmitri Glukowski's play, The White Factory.
Okay, great. This is all coming back to me now, because now it's been how long since we saw this play together? We had the great pleasure of getting to go to a play together.
Was that the first play we've seen? It was. It's the first play we saw. That was October 2023.
Oh my gosh.
What is life? Where has
the time gone? yeah, that was such a special time. But it's all coming back to me, that opening moment. I remember just a very, it was a very striking stage, and it was all white. And yep. That comes into play later. So,
and I know the exact moment you're referring to. Yep. Yep.
Yep.
Well,
yep.
Before we go into that, we said at the beginning of the episode that it's dedicated to the memory of Adrian Schiller. Adrian passed away very suddenly and unexpectedly on the 3rd of April 2024. He had an amazing acting career. He had leading roles with the Royal Shakespeare Company. He appeared in multiple films and TV series. If you're in the UK, you know, Prime Suspect, Victoria, you know, was in those. And in the world premiere of The White Factory at the Marylebone Theatre in 2023, which is the one that Alex and I went to see, Adrian played Chaim Ronkowski and Old Ezekiel. So we both saw him perform. I think I can safely say for both of us that we were just riveted. And I don't think... I feel like when he... Was it you or me who sent... We got the link through saying, oh, you know, here's all the nominations and things for the, you know, the Off West End Awards. Mm-hmm. And we saw that he'd been nominated for an award for lead performance, and we were completely not surprised. But I think we were both really surprised that he didn't win it.
Is there an ensemble a nomination as well?
I don't think there was, but
okay, so that was just in my dream. That was my dream for them, because they were an amazing ensemble.
Because the set designer, I think she won the set design off. Okay. And then the White Factory as a whole, as a production, won the Offie for Best Production.
Okay, yes.
Which was completely not surprising, because it's
no
brilliant.
Yeah.
Not that we're
no,
biased
I
at
really,
all.
Not at all. I really enjoyed the play. I think just to, so educators, students have that are listening in and are interested in these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I don't know, do you want to... tell us a little bit more, because you have a PhD in
really
Holocaust
we've never
theater.
Mentioned it
listeners
here
just yeah, just it. Well, I think it bears repeating because you know we don't know how yeah. what the my personal memory and also the memory is of some of our listeners.
Hey,
but,
might be their first episode, so
that's right. Yeah, so hi. there's nothing wrong with reintroducing. Also, could you tell us just a little bit more about Umkowski and who he was, since this is so heavily based on his story? Yeah,
it definitely is. So, the theme of this week's episode is it's the first episode in our series, Impossible Choices. So we've had some discussions around how we want to frame future episodes, and you know, kind of some of the themes and the strands that we'd like to pull out of the plays that we work with. And so we are going to be doing different series. So for example, we're going to have a Portrayals of Perpetrators series. We're going to have a We Are the Women series that looks at women and representations of women in the Holocaust. We're going to have a Representing Rescue and Resistance series. So this is the first in the Impossible Choices series. And Chaim Ronkowski, he's a really controversial figure. So how to make a long story very short. So when the Nazis set up ghettos in occupied Europe, the majority of the times they would nominate, in inverted commas, a Judenrat or a Jewish council. And this was essentially a committee of Jewish elders who were tasked with cooperating with the Nazis and making sure that Nazi decrees were carried out in the ghetto and essentially keeping law and order, for want of a better way of putting it. And Chaim Ronkowski is perhaps one of the most, if not the most, notorious heads of any of the Judenrats in the history of that time. He was a unsuccessful businessman and an orphanage director. He is or was also an alleged sex offender. I'm not going to go into any further details. Against women and children. That's it. And, you know, is seen, depending on which school of thought or which angle you're coming at it from, some people think that he was just this power-hungry megalomaniac who, you know, exploited his position to the fullest, the same as he would have done in civilian life, and other people think that he was just very misguided and was doing the best that he could in horrendous circumstances and, you know, just got his head turned along the way. But, you know, he had his own, so for example, he had his own horse and carriage in the ghetto. He would nominate friends and family members to higher positions in sort of the ghetto leadership. He had currency and I think as well postage stamps within the ghetto printed with his face on them. And, you know, there are a lot of questions around his interactions with children. And, you know, whether he essentially was a paedophile and targeted children. And also there were allegations both before and after the war that he demanded sexual favours or sexually abused women that either worked for him or that, you know, were seeking help. And that he was a really, really particularly nasty piece of work. He gave a really infamous speech, which is just known as the Give Me Your Children speech, in, I think it was 1942, where he basically told the assembled ghetto inhabitants that the Nazis were demanding transports of certain numbers to be deported, and that he was trying to essentially cut off a limb to save the whole. And that, you know, he was horrified and devastated and stood before them a broken man, but that they needed to send all of the children up to the age of 10 and send them away. If you look at, there's an edited version of his speech that's been given by the British actor Tobias Menzies. And if you look on the Arcola Theatre website, he does a version of it. And it's brilliant because the Arcola have also done some teaching resources and questions for teachers, and you can find that, and that'll be in our show notes. So again, just you can hit, and because Łódź, which, you know, had been sort of this massive centre of like textile production before the war, and then under sort of Ronkowski and also what the Nazis wanted, it became almost like this. There was a lot of essentially forced labour in the ghetto, because Ronkowski believed that if they worked hard enough, the Nazis would leave them alone and ultimately the ghetto would survive, even if, you know, people were lost along the way, essentially. And it's kind of really horrible and ironic because when you think about, you know, Arbeit macht frei, work will set you free, being above the gates in Auschwitz and so many of the other concentration and death camps, and then, you know, Ronkowski is literally saying, you know, our path to freedom is through work. And you can, he was, in some ways he was right, because the Łódź ghetto, I think, was one of the last, if not the last, ghetto to be liquidated in late 1944. And then Ronkowski, official records say that he died in Auschwitz towards the end of August 1944. But there are also some other accounts that say actually he was beaten to death on the train on the way there because of everything that he had done or had alleged to have done. So that is a very long story. But yeah, so Chaim Ronkowski is one of the most controversial Jewish figures of the Holocaust. And he is actually represented in the White Factory. And also Wilhelm Kopp was real. He was the butcher of Kulmhof.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, so and so begins our Impossible Choices series. So who are we mostly following in this play?
So the protagonist is Josef Kaufmann. And he is a, you know, sort of young Jewish lawyer. He's married. He has two sons who I think are sort of like 7 and 9. They're quite young. And it's basically his perspective. So after the scene in Germany, it's then 1960s America. He has survived and finds out that Kopp has been arrested. And then the play up until the end scene is then told in flashback and him remembering what happened. So it kind of moves in a linear fashion from that point with, you know, things that happen in the Łódź ghetto, you know, just before the Holocaust begins and sort of like pre-war life. And then, yeah, sort of just follows Josef as he and his family are forced into the ghetto. They're forced to wear the Yellow Star. They're forced to realise, you know, how difficult things are becoming, the terrible situation they're in. Josef is able to get work as an interpreter because his mother was German, so he speaks German. And then as he tries to save his family, you know, the decisions become more, what choice can I make that's most likely, it's still awful, but most likely to guarantee our survival. He ultimately becomes a member of the Jewish police in the ghetto, mm-hmm. and is forced to take part in roundups to try and save his family. And then at the end of the play, it's him facing down Kopp in a courtroom and deciding whether or not to say, yes, I knew this man and I can bear witness to what he did and I can confirm that this is actually what he did and who he was. But by doing so, he then has to bring his own past to light as someone who essentially collaborated and took part in the roundups of, for example, children, and it feeds into the give me your children speech. Or does he say, no, I don't remember, I don't know who this man is, and ultimately save himself, but in saving himself, right, let Kopp go free.
Right. Yeah. So, so ultimately, I feel like we felt this would be, I don't know, how did you feel? Is this a good play to teach in the classroom?
My immediate response is yes, but my God, you'd have to be so careful. I don't know if it's because of the content matter, that the hint that there was sexual bartering and that, you know, not even sexual bartering, it's rape, let's face it. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't forced, but there was no consent between Rivka, who's Joseph's wife, and Ronkowski, because she's desperate to try, you know, she's trying to get a position in, you know, working for the Judenrat again, to sort of like try and get her dad's name off of the deportation lists.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's, you know, you can open up that element, and obviously sexual violence against Jewish women in the Holocaust and, you know, this notion of quote unquote sexual bartering and the choiceless choice and kind of going, what do I do? Is there, and also, you know, the fact that there are no, all the areas are grey, there is no black and white.
Makes the title of White Factory very
right.
Yeah, ironic, honestly.
That's a really good point.
Yeah,
and it's just, and I quick side note, the White Factory was the a former Catholic, again historically accurate, Roman Catholic church in Łódź that was used to stuff pillows with the feathers of pillows that had been confiscated from Jews. So they were basically like restuffing all the pillows and everything, and the clouds of the feathers basically turned the building inside white, and it became nicknamed the White Factory, and that's where the name comes from, and you see some of that in the play.
Yeah.
You know, and again, this whole thing about like the impossible choices and who is quote unquote good, who is quote unquote evil? Why did people make decisions? What were the dilemmas? What responses did people have? Why? These are all the themes that you can look at. So it's definitely for older students.
Yeah, I mean, go on. Yeah, like junior, seniors, and probably into college. Would you recommend it for, sorry, for in the American...
I guess that was like, what's that
American
in, what's school that in English?
System, that's like, I would say 16 to 18 year olds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, because when we saw it at the Marleyburn, they were like, oh, you know, suitable for ages 8+.
No.
Yeah.
Maybe for some more mature British students, but...
No. Yeah, like not... I would have said minimum 14+. Watch the play, but to actually study it and go into it properly with like the resources and minimum age 16 to 18.
But I think one of the first things we said was that this is a good text to work with just because it just the characters are so nuanced. And you see they start off, you know, principled, but then you see the deterioration of those principles after getting a sense of, you exactly. know, what had to be done, what their choices were, which are impossible choices.
Yeah.
The choices. So that was one of the things we really came away with. I think it's an interesting introduction to the concept of the Jewish police, which I think is something that, I mean, I don't remember really knowing about the existence of those right. positions until like maybe, I don't know, college or when I was really, you know, kind of went off on my own Holocaust education. But we appreciated how like even with that it didn't portray Jewish people as betraying snakes, which was definitely a theme in the anti-Semitism that started to come up again after the Holocaust and still does.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also excellent throughout the play these excellent references to Jewish mythology and stories, I feel like is really important when we go into Holocaust education, that it's approached with this also understanding and appreciation of the Jewish culture and
exactly
and life and values, because you know we're studying the Holocaust to, you know, to combat discrimination, prejudices, anti-Semitism, racism, so and to combat the anti-Semitism, you know, we have to also approach it with like a love and appreciation for what that is, what
exactly
it means to be
and
Jewish.
I think I remember when we were talking after the play, and we had a lot to say. We were like, we need to make some notes about this. That sort of that emphasis as well of rehumanizing and pre-war Jewish life, and showing the richness of the culture and what was lost.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there's one of the sort of main turning points and sort of like plot points throughout it, especially in the ghetto scenes, this creature, this man that is created from clay by a rabbi in Prague, and goes out every night to watch over the town and the city and protect Jews from being attacked. It's the golem.
The golem. I was gonna say
is to this day is sleeping in the attic of the Grand Synagogue in Prague. Just this whole idea of thought of like for hundreds, thousands of years, Jews have needed protection. This is not new. Anti-Semitism is not new. It's not something the Nazis invented. So the Jewish people being able to draw on that cultural heritage, to be able to draw on that, you know, rich fabric of their lives and their identity, and that's what the Nazis were trying to wipe out. And just drawing on that, so again, that so we're not just seeing a snapshot of these people as victims, we're actually seeing these are our traditions, this is our history, this is how far back it goes, it's back for millennia. That's so important. So again, that's another way into the text and being able to look at Jewish culture, identity and heritage.
yeah Yeah, it was the timing of watching this play. Not only like was it, you know, perfect timing, I could see it with you, but also I was this was during a trip where I was going to London, and then right after that I went to Prague.
Cool.
Because I'm half Czech. My mom was born in Prague, and so my step grandmother still lives there.
Amazing.
And I hadn't seen her in a while. And of course, while I was there, you know, did some research, went to visited all the synagogues in Prague, and you know, went to the old synagogue where the golem is sleeping.
I'm so jealous. I want to go.
It was really perfect timing, and so it was nice to see that play and then go to Prague, see all the synagogues. And then I also went to the museum of Karl Gemina, who is mm-hmm. the father of really like practical effects in cinema.
Oh, wow.
So I went through that museum. It's intended for kids, but you know, I'm a big kid. So I had such a lovely time. Don't grow up. You know, it's one of those things, like, I've seen this before, and then you see it, you know, echoed throughout cinema. Mm. It's just, it was really cool to, like, see that and then remember the play, because there was, that production that we saw was really making use of camera and projections. Mm. How could you best describe what was going on? They would, you know, that whenever they would get into sections where the grandfather, yeah. where old Ezekiel, played by Adrian, so Adrian played two characters, mm-hmm. Runkowski, and then old Ezekiel, the father, that was the father of Joe, right?
His father-in-law. No. He was Rivka's dad.
His father-in-law, thank you.
Yes.
So there would be these interludes where he would be entertaining the children with mm-hmm. Jewish folklore, and then when that happens, the back of the stage would open up, and there would be projections of the story, and there would be use of the camera where mm-hmm. There'd be a live camera that would come on stage and sort of would capture stills of
sometimes the live camera came on stage, and so yeah, like you're saying with the stills, they would quote unquote take pictures that would then be projected onto the back of the stage for like the identity papers. Mm-hmm. But then they would kind of, it was almost like a live action capture of the characters inserting themselves into these stories. So you'd have these animations being played on the back of the stage, and then
reanimated.
Yeah, but then like the faces and the movements of the actors were then being either incorporated or incredibly well timed, so it looked like they were incorporated into these like animations showing the golem and like people flying and fighting and all these kind of things. Because there was the one, wasn't there, about the legend of the monster in Krakow.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So again, just, and the fact that, you know, Gollum is from Prague, the monster that comes, and then I think it's the Jewish man sacrificed himself so that the others could run in Krakow. So again, really subtly showing that how wide the diaspora is and was, and mm-hmm. how many countries have this rich Jewish heritage. And yeah, and I mean, that play was so good. I mean, that the play itself is good, but the production was just... And I think we do need to reference as well the fact that it was written by... and I can't find his name. Dmitry Glukowski, and directed by Maxim Dudenko. And they are Russian... I don't know, forgive me, I can't remember which one is Russian and which one is Ukrainian, but they are both essentially political exiles and are both very outspoken opponents of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. So also having that sort of contemporary relevance echoing through the writing and the directing, especially when you look at, you know, the Holocaust in the Soviet Union and the Einsatzgruppen, which were the special killing squads that went out and committed the Holocaust by bullets. Make a note, Alex, we'll cover that in another episode. But that side of things as well. So sort of, and again, coming back to what you were saying about this is why we teach about the Holocaust, and this is why we have plays and things about the Holocaust, is to look at the contemporary echoes and to look at the resonance.
Yeah, and I remember we, in our discussions, we were, you know, how do we teach or work with this play? And you mentioned this already, like, it's not a play to start, you know, your education of Holocaust with. No. So it definitely would be useful to complement Holocaust history teaching. Yep. It's good with asking the, you know, the whys, avoids, I had written my notes, avoids the question of what would you have done?
God, yeah, please, yeah. If we could, yeah. Educators, please don't ask your students that.
Because it's impossible. We can only, you know...
Yeah, no, because you can't. Don't get me started. Yeah, we'll just say, don't ask that question. Along with, let's imagine that, ... No, don't imagine it. Let's pretend that, nope, don't, mm-hmm. please, just, no, please.
Just listen and let it wash over you.
Yeah.
We'll keep coming back to it, and the hope is, you know, the lessons will stick.
Yes.
And it's just a present thought I'm having here. This is by no means, like, gospel is something to live by. I'm just like, this is how I'm processing.
No, I think that's a good way to look at it. Actually, I really like that. Just let it sit with you, and you sit with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I probably said it before, I'm gonna keep saying it. Just, you know, we don't want to, I mean, we're already in a race against the clock all the time. So, and there's so much pressure put on, you know, us as students and as educators, just like, okay, we need qualitative data now. Like, we need to see how this is making a difference now. We're not going to know until later down the road. So I think we could just, like, trust, you know, we're all listening. We're all giving each other grace, as long as we're questioning, growing, and exposing ourselves to as many stories as possible.
Notwithstanding the 2024 US elections.
No.
I'm sorry. I said it.
Yeah. But we said also it's good for exploring the human, just nuanced human aspect to all this, and just reminding students, you know, it's not black and white. All of life is not.
Exactly. And I think, yeah, I mean, this feeds back into, you know, my mantra as an educator, which is, you know, you've got to give your students the time and the space to work things out for themselves, to work things through, to process them. And I don't mean necessarily within your lessons, within the actual space of being in the class, but giving them the questions, or encouraging them to think about the questions when they're not in, you know, with you, when they're not actually taking part in the lessons, but to go, why is this happening? What is going on? Am I okay with it? And what did, okay, so he was in the Jewish police. What were the Jewish police? What did they do? Who, you know, what was their role? Or Łódź, where, you know, where is that? Or just all the things around, getting them from the real sort of, the basic history and the, you know, the baseline historical facts, and going, okay, this is where Łódź is in Poland, this is a city, all the way through to, okay, what were some of the choices, or what were some of the consequences facing people that could have informed the decisions they made?
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the circumstances that were going on? So looking at things like, you know, food and saving family members and basic survival and adequate shelter and those kinds of things. If those needs aren't being met, how did that potentially factor into how and why people made decisions?
Mm-hmm.
And just getting them thinking.
It's something we're talking a lot about in the, you know, Holocaust education educator realm, is just, you know, how do we get across to students? And it's becoming clear, just simply saying, look at what happened, isn't it awful? We need you to understand how awful this is, like, isn't necessarily getting to getting through to students quite as effectively as one would hope. So it's more where we're trying to, any way that we can try to approach from a problem solving perspective, not asking a question like what would you have done, it's just, but really looking into deeply into the the context of all of these choices and decisions,
right,
that people then had to make.
It just boils down to two simple words: critical thinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just getting them thinking critically, and also us as educators as well, because we're never going to know everything.
Right.
There are people who come very, very close. There are several academics I know that come really quite scarily close, but no one will ever know everything about the Holocaust. And
we're still learning things.
Exactly. So, I think, yeah, just sort of framing it in that context, and it's okay not to know something as long as you want to know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah. Challenges, issues with the play?
Again, spoiler alert, so if you don't want to know what happens, skip ahead 15 seconds. The shooting on stage. Really well done in terms of the production at the Marylebone. I don't know if it is actually meant to be seen on stage or not. I think it probably is, but there's obviously different ways that you can do it. But yeah, I think sort of like some of the violence it's not an issue, but I would say that could be a bit of a challenge.
Yeah.
And I think as well, I know we've already covered this in terms of the ages of the students, and you know, if you're going to work with your students working with this play, but some of the really difficult questions around again sexual violence and you know, that aspect of things, and there's a representation of death by suicide and shooting, and people get beaten up, and but it's not constant, it's not gratuitous, it adds to the story, it really helps to add additional context, and I would say a valuable shock at times. And again, I'm sort of referring back to the suicide and the shooting. And again, the actual subject matter, and the rounding up of the children and the interactions between Josef and some of the parents when he's going around and collecting the children aged under 10 to be taken away for deportation.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that, I think, could be quite difficult. So I just think it's really crucial, if as an educator you're thinking of working with the play, is to read it first. I mean, I'm assuming that you'd be able to get hold of a copy. I don't believe that it's been published at the moment, but to BC. But if it's again with any play like this, have a read first. No one's going to know your students better than you. So have a read of it and kind of go, thinking of my class, how are they going to respond to this? How are they going to work with this? Is it good for them? If you pick it up and read it and go, it's a great play, but no, not for my students, that's, yeah, go that way. I just think, you know, because it's a heavy hitter, it's a hard hitter, it should be, it needs to be.
It should be.
So I mean, with all Holocaust plays, you should be careful, but especially with this one, because it is so, so good that it delivers a really, really strong punch.
Yeah.
And you really need to factor that in.
Yeah, I would say this is a good play to explore with students after you have really, you've already studied a lot or know a lot about the Nazi party and the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this gives a window into just how that their influence trickled down and affected everyone that they were persecuting, not just outside of the concentration camps. This really gets into you know, because we go straight in Holocaust education, we go straight to the concentration camps.
Exactly.
I don't think there's enough talk about what exactly how the ghettos operated.
Yeah, and you know the conditions there, and yeah, that's such a great point. Yeah. And how the conditions in the ghetto were calculated to kill people. These were not conditions for survival. In a lot of ways, it's incredible that Rumkowski was able to get the ghetto to last as long as it did. You know, up until August 1944. That's amazing. But I think as well, just thinking about it, I think this would be a really good play to study at university or college level.
Yeah.
And because you can really do a deep dive with those students into plays like this and go, what do we think about this and how could you? This play would be perfect for that. But I also think as well, even if you're sort of stepping away from sort of like the what I call the direct educational aspect of it, but in terms of like broader, just like the public and seeing this play, would I recommend it? Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Without any hesitation.
Definitely.
But again, having those content warnings. And just being like, this is necessary. It's not pretty, but it's necessary.
What would be your forward review? What's our forward? you said heavy hitter.
Heavy hitter. Oh, forward review. I would say challenging. Provocative.
Yeah.
Necessary. And I don't know if nuanced.
Yeah.
And if it's, I don't know, if, here's a question for you. If a word has a hyphen in it, are we counting that as one word or two?
One word, I think.
Okay, then hard hitting.
Hard hitting, yeah.
So yeah, so my four words would be challenging, provocative, necessary, and hard hitting.
Yeah.
What's your four word review?
Oh God, why do I have to go second? Because you just said everything.
Because you asked me first,
and I am just so I know I that was my bad. Rookie I should have known better as the most inarticulate person I know.
Oh hush.
Yeah, I mean, you want every, you know, you would hope every production you see is nuanced, but this one was really like the way that I'm just thinking of the production. I'm not even just focused on the content of the play, but just everyone was just, it was so lived in.
Yes.
So just tragically human. I don't know. Can I just end there? It's just, it gave an entry point in just this, a new entry point into just the torture. I don't know, but like the production itself wasn't torture, but it's just tragic.
It's an
dark, tragic, necessary nuance.
You can't have necessary because I already said that.
I know, but I'm stealing it.
Okay. So it's that good. We're saying it twice. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a conversation for us to have another time. Yeah. I really keep this in the recording. I really want us to have a conversation around the notion of the Holocaust as a quote unquote tragedy. I have heard, I've heard so many differing viewpoints around the Holocaust as a tragedy, and I think it's really interesting and actually really relevant, because obviously tragedy is part of theatre. So that's another conversation for another time. So what was it you said? Tragic, necessary, nuanced,
dark.
And dark. It is all of those things. It is, and
it's a very bright set, very dark content. I mean, all of these plays will be, but it's just the way that, because I mean, you see it throughout. I'm just getting my show notes again.
The
different kind of
box.
Torture.
It was the production was essentially in this white box. The stage was a white box, and at times, you know, the lighting was incredibly bright and intimidating and almost painful. And but like you say, it was kind of this very white, bright box populated with this incredibly dark subject matter and this incredibly dark narrative that was going on.
Yeah,
I mean, if we were going, here's another one. So, or another question. So we've done our four-word review. How many stars out of five?
Oh, out of five. Okay.
Well, I mean, we could do five, and then we can do a score out of 10 if you want. I mean,
no, it's good to have five. I don't want to, you know.
Yeah, let's not confuse it.
I would say 4 out of 5.
Ooh, what and what would?
Why that last the no?
Yeah, the why the
minus one star? I think just because there were just so many threads going on that sometimes, you know, it got, I don't know, I got a little lost, like, you know, as an audience member, but because I wondered, well, because we're mostly following Yosef, and then I started to forget the first scene and why we had it with the arrest of Wilhelm Kopp. So there was a part of me I was just like, I don't know, I guess I needed that thread, that first opening moment, threaded in a bit more. And I guess we did have it, because, you know, we do see him, we see their interactions more. But yeah. There was a part of me, I was like, did we have to, I don't know. I guess I had questions about the way it was, the order of it all. I guess because you just going over the synopsis now just reminded me. Oh, right, that is how it opened.
yeah.
So I guess the weaving, I don't know, it was excellent weaving, not perfect for me. So, and you'd mentioned the camera work was a little distracting sometimes, but...
yeah, especially if there was a bit that you couldn't quite see or access, you suddenly like, and I mean you plurally, not you, Alex, but just kind of like shifting around in your seat and kind of going, oh, I can't quite see that bit, or I can't quite see that bit.
I think also the weaving in of like the storyline, I guess what was hard for me there was just that we weren't able to get into Yosef's personal journey enough, you know, there was like a flip.
Yeah,
we weren't able to get enough of a clear flip for him.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It didn't.
Now we're just rambling, and now the teachers and educators are like, why are you, I don't care about your opinion. So maybe we'll just like cut all this and just say, we recommend it. Go. But you know your students best, as you said.
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I think I would quite do the start. I would give it, I would say 4.5. I'm going to
give
it half.
Yes, okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because I, like you say, it wasn't perfect, and there were some aspects, yeah, like Yosef's, that's a really interesting point that I hadn't really considered, is that, you know, it doesn't quite, you see, like, his mental decline and how it's affecting him, and I feel like that could have been pushed maybe a little bit more. I don't know how, don't ask, but I feel like that could have maybe been pushed a little bit more. But yeah, Adrian's performance, obviously, just, and the way that he embodied sort of like this old man who had to use sticks to get around and had like this very strong Eastern European accent, and like kind of like a quote unquote older voice, to embodying the, you know, Rumkowski, as sort of like quite upright and quite fit, even for, you know, a man who's sort of in his 60s, and was just, and the moments with the children and working and, you know, sort of talking to the children and telling them the stories and that kind of thing. So yeah, I would say 4.5 out of 5.
Yeah.
So, but I think that's it from us for this episode.
Yeah. And, again, this is dedicated and, to memory of Adrian, may his memory be a blessing.
Yes.
I know we really wanted to interview him for this podcast, and
it would have been,
no, we won't, so
I'm really delighted to confirm that we will be speaking to his brother-in-law, Stephen Unwin, in a future episode, so we will be looking at some of Stephen's work. I'm not gonna
I didn't realize they were late. I'm so excited.
I'm not gonna tell anybody what we're doing. They're gonna have to wait until the episode premieres, but yeah, we will be speaking with Stephen talking about one of his plays, and yeah, I'm so excited because I saw the play a few years ago and again was riveted. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening to us for our musings and while we talk about these plays. And yeah, we will see you next time. All of our sources and our contact information is in the show notes. Get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love your thoughts and feedback. And look after yourselves, be kind, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.